Committee on Human Services and Housing today, Friday, February 8th, 2013. With that, we're going to open a public hearing and possible, work session after that. I said that. Open up the public hearing on House Bill 2082. Regina, this is our first bill, you guys, of this session. All right.
House Bill 2082 modifies definitions related to social work and the composition of the State Board of Licensed Social Workers. There is no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact. It does have a fiscal impact statement and no revenue impact statement.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay. All right. We have three people who have signed up, and two of you want to come together. Is that right? Martin Pidioni and Kathy Outland. And should we bring up Laura? Is that okay? Laura Majeski. Am I pronouncing that right? Good. It's good to see you all. And you're going to have a PowerPoint, and then we're going to open up the blinds and let the sunshine in.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Martin Pitioni. I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Board of Licensed Social Workers, and I'm very pleased to be before you today to present House Bill 2082, which is an agency bill from the board, together with board member Kathy Outland, who is next to me, and Laura Majeski from NESW, from the National Association of Social Workers Oregon chapter. Very briefly, I'd like to just walk you through the background of this bill and say to you up front that we're very grateful to be here, because this is actually a successor bill to a Senate bill that was worked in this committee in 2009, Senate Bill 177, that created significant reforms in the social work regulatory framework and was worked in this committee in its final form, and we're very grateful for that outcome. So prior to passage, the context for this bill is because it's a follow-on bill. It's probably easiest to explain this in the context of what we originally did in 2009 and what that means in terms of where this bill takes us next, because it really is a follow-on bill. Prior to the social work reforms that were passed by the legislature in 2009, the Board of Licensed Social Workers only had two voluntary licensing options at the clinical level of social work. And that was a significant public protection issue, because we simply didn't have the ability to protect the public from unlicensed practice, including by those who had their license revoked previously by the board. We were able to garner strong bipartisan support in 2009 for those reforms, and those then in the end kicked in 2011. And this bill really is the next step forward after this bill. So let's talk in slightly more specificity about what those reforms were and what gets touched and what doesn't get touched by House Bill 2082 as a follow-on bill. There were three primary pieces to Senate Bill 177. One is that we moved to mandatory licensure for those who practice clinical social work only. And for just the shorthand version, when I use the word clinical, you can basically substitute the word basically mental health related practice of this very large field of social work. Okay, and basically what that bill did is that for anyone who engages in that conduct, who practices at the clinical level, has to be licensed. Now, some of you who weren't here on this committee before may kind of wonder about that part, but the reality is that in healthcare, we didn't treat everybody equally, and the same type of expectation that a public citizen had about walking into a doctor's office, walking into a nurse's office, walking into a dentist's office, and expecting that that person would be licensed, that same expectation was there by a member of the public when it came to mental health, including social work, except that it wasn't true. And we fixed that in 2009. 2009. In addition, we wrote a narrow set of exemptions. I won't get into those in detail now because it is pretty much mandatory licensure. And the key of this bill that is before you today is that this, the 2009 bill, notwithstanding the broad bipartisan reform, was a heavy lift. There was a lot of work going on behind the scenes. There was a lot of compromising going on behind the scenes. And the key piece about 2082 is that we are not moving the goalposts of what we established in 2009. There are no changes in this bill of who has to become licensed and who doesn't have to become licensed within the practice field of social work. And that was critical in bringing you a bill with respect that maintains consensus and also minimizing fiscal impact, which is another key issue for this committee. The second part that of the social work reforms contains the remaining two elements of what we did in 2009. One is that we created for the first time voluntary licensing options on the non-clinical side, where we had no licensing options before. Those are now around since January 1, 2011, as the registered baccalaureate social worker option and the licensed master's social worker licensing options. And we've had phenomenal strong response in the social work community to those licensing options. Our latest data has already 500 folks that have come forward to get licensed voluntarily with those two license options. The other piece you probably recall, because it was specifically done in this committee, is that we also added as part of this bill very strong title protections for the term social worker. And by strong, I mean that it was the combo deal of you have to have a degree in social work and you have to be licensed by the board in order to call yourself a social worker. And so those were all the positive things. What we didn't get to, and this is why we're here today, is we were not able, with all the lifting that was going on in 2009 to get this bill through in a broad consensus, we were not able to get to the work of let's work on the actual definitions for those new layers that we've just added in. We just added that layer at the bachelor level non-clinical. We just added the layer of master's level non-clinical, but there was no language in the bill that survived that actually defined what the practice is at those levels. And we need to fill in those blanks. So think of House Bill 2082 really as kind of an add-on piece that simply fills in some of the gaps that were still left by 177, but without changing the framework of what we did in 2009. That also includes updating the definition of the clinical practice side, because now that we have these layers, we have to make sure that it's concise and clear what distinguishes these layers, and we cannot get there with the current definition of clinical social work in statute, because that definition, simply put, was written 30 years ago. Okay, and Kathy Outland is going to talk a little bit later about how those definitions got there, and that's not an Oregon-specific product, but really a product of national work. So what specifically are we doing now in 2082? One is you're replacing the clinical definition. That's what I just mentioned, the old 30-year one, and basically allows us to put a more tiered definition in place that's specific. Here's the part that's clinical. Here are the pieces that are non-clinical, and go from there. And it does follow a national model. The other piece that's in this bill, and was mentioned briefly by Ms. Wilson at the introduction, is there is also a small board governance piece in this bill. And what's going on there is, very briefly, is the Board of Licensed Social Workers is a seven-member board appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. Of those seven members, four are, under current statute, required to be licensed at the highest level, licensed clinical social worker. The other three are public members. And what this bill does is it does not change the size of the board, which is why we minimized, which is how we minimized fiscal impact, because it leaves the size the same. But it takes one of the four professional member positions and says the governor has the option for that position to appoint someone from any of the other license types as well. So if you are an RBSW, if you are have an LMSW, if you have a CSWA, you now have a pathway to be considered by the governor's office for appointment. And that's simply something where we're doing also a little bit of filling in the blanks from what we didn't get done in 2009 to kind of give everybody a shot within that range of the licensing options of being able to be a candidate for membership on the board. So overall, talking about impacts, the mandatory licensure requirements that we established in the 2009 bill are unchanged by this bill. There are no change to any of the exemptions, which is why you don't have, you know, protesting hordes in front of you today. There are no changes to the title protections. And for specifically the license types, the impacts are for LCSWs. It gives them an updated clinical definition that reflects current practice. It doesn't change, you know, mandatory licensure. It doesn't change their ability to access insurance panels. For our CSWAs, there are no changes to their program. The only change for them really is that they are opened up for consideration for board appointment. And for the new license types, the LMSWs and the RBSWs, they see the major gain under this bill because we have been in a really awkward position of not really being able to tell them definitively, this is what's okay for you to do. We've only been able to tell them you can't do that. And that was a very, very awkward position for us to be in. And quite frankly, through very careful implementation and maintaining consensus in how we roll this out, you know, we've built enough trust in the stakeholder community that we now say, okay, let's take this next step further, which doesn't move the goalposts of who needs to get licensed, but it does say, let's give them some clarity as to what it means to be an LMSW and an RBSW. And that's why you have this bill here before you.
Remind us, please, what RBSW?
I'm sorry, that's the bachelor level option that was added new. That's the non-clinical bachelor level registered baccalaureate social worker. That's basically a certification option at the bachelor level, which we didn't have before. So if you graduate from an accredited program or program in candidacy from the accrediting body called from the social work accrediting body, and you graduate with a bachelor's degree in social work, a BSW, then you are now have a licensing option, which you didn't have prior to January 1, 2011, and you can come in and be licensed as an RBSW.
The right? R stands for registered.
Yes.
And LMSW is licensed?
Licensed master's social worker.
Okay.
So it doesn't have the word clinical in it because that one does not permit
right.
clinical
got
practice.
Got that. Any questions while we stop here for a minute? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. So according to this, in terms of definitions, am I to understand then the bachelor's level RBSW is prohibited from participating in clinical social work?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, by definition, bachelor level practice does not permit clinical level work.
By whose definition?
By the national model law definition.
And, that's an area in which I'm mm-hmm. versed, having directed the BSW program at University of Portland. And clearly, I guess what we need to see is how mm-hmm. mental health practices defined, and, you know, because there are cases where there's certainly counseling. We've had internships in mental health, and so, you know, implementing this would would put some restrictions on that kind of practice. And then when we think about, you know, we had DSH in here, Department of Human Services in here last Wednesday, and, you know, the whole issue of classification and cost distribution are things that we have to consider, and certainly MSWs cost more than BSWs do. And so I think those kinds of things, I think, need to be considered as well.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, I want to provide a brief answer for a moment and then maybe ask that we have Kathy Outland talk a little bit more about the definitions and where those come from. Very briefly, I would like to make it clear on the record that somebody being involved in mental health practice is a pretty broad term, and that may not necessarily be a problem. The devil really is in the details here. It's about, are you the one are you the one actually writing the treatment plan? Okay. Are you the one actually making a diagnosis, a mental health diagnosis? And that's kind of one of those significant, it's not about you can't be in the room or you can't assist with essentially social work services that are in mental health, but the issue is, are you in the driver's seat?
Yeah.
Are you making that diagnosis? And if you are making a diagnosis, that's clinical. And that would be, I think, a significant discomfort level, I would put that politely, with having that happen at the bachelor level.
Can I follow up question?
Follow up?
Sort of along the same line in terms of the definitions and so on. Also, there was concern, I think, with the previous bill that there were questions around teaching of social work practice and whether or not the teaching of social work practice was considered a practice and that the instructors had to be LCSWs as well. Is that something you could...
Yeah, I can speak to that. Representative Tomei, Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, that issue was directly addressed in 2009, and basically the way it was addressed is that the... because it was really primarily came up through the issue of... if someone teaches, since there's only a requirement under law now for someone to become licensed on the based on what they do, if they work clinically, the question came up, well, if you teach clinical methods, does that mean you have to become licensed? And that was resolved with a no, okay, because the issue is, do you serve a client? Is there a client? That was the standard that basically was developed. So is there a client at the other end of the equation? Because this is primarily, the agency is a public protection agency, right? And is there a client at the other end that is being directly served?
Okay.
So if you're supervising a field practicum and there is direct practice going on, that's where things get a little on the dicey side. But just somebody coming in and talking about clinical practice pieces in a teaching setting is where we've drawn the line, saying there is no requirement unless on the title side they say, I want to call myself a social worker. If they want to use that title, they have to become licensed. But then it has nothing to do with teaching. It has everything to do with what is the title that they're using.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Unlike Representative Gallegos, this is much newer for me, so permit me just a few quick questions. One is, it sounds like it's mandatory licensing for clinical workers and voluntary for non-clinical. Wondered if you could tell me what the advantages are for why people would want to if it's voluntary. And I'll just throw out the questions because you might be able to answer them all at once. What's the cost of licensing for the different... If there are different license levels, how many people are licensed in each of those categories, and what are the exemptions right now?
Okay, that's you may need a Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Goye, you may need to help me stay on track in terms of making sure that I answer all of those pieces. So let's first of all take the question on who would want to become licensed. My experience is there are a lot of folks out there who take a great deal of pride in the term social worker, and many of them didn't want to give that up and wanted to come in. Two, many have been wanting to become licensed for a long time and didn't have that option because they weren't doing it. They weren't doing clinical social work. There was just no way for them to do so. Three, there are also employment place dynamics at work here, because sometimes, you know, it's not just about what does the board have as, you know, basically the bottom floor requirement. Often employers drive this as well, because sometimes employers, such as, for example, hospital systems, come in and saying, we prefer to hire people that are licensed. Mm-hmm. Now that this option is out there, employers make their own decisions in terms of what's right for them, and that may also drive issues now. So partially, quite frankly, sometimes employability is an issue, because if you're out there in the marketplace, you may have a better chance getting hired if you're also licensed, even if it's not necessarily mandated for you to do so. So there are, I think, a lot of drivers there. Let me give you a very rough sense of the numbers.
Is reimbursement one of them as well?
No.
No. Okay.
No. The only way you get access to insurance panels is through the clinical level.
Okay.
Very, very briefly on the numbers. First of all, overall size of the board, we've grown tremendously. When I started with the board in 08, we had roughly about 3,300 licensees. We have, because of these reforms, just under 5,000 now. Okay. And we're easily going to be above 5,000 by the end of this biennium. So within that, I'm going to just give you the rough numbers off the top of my head. There's about 3,500 total folks licensed on the LCSW side. There is about 800. There's about 800 some CSWAs. We've had explosive growth in our CSWA program, the entry level clinical program. It used to have maybe like 400 or 500. We now are over 800 in that program, and that's the gateway program. Those folks will trigger eventually into the LCSW level, because you have to be there for 2 years before you can get into the LCSW level licensure. And we have roughly about 500 in the new non-clinical license types. Most of those are at the master's level. There is not that many at the RBSW level. I think we have somewhere around 40 right now. So that's the rough breakout. You also asked the question about fees. I don't want to bore you with the whole fee structure, but the basic pieces are, if you apply at the clinical level, it is a lot more work for us. The clinical level application fees are $150 for the initial application fee. On the non-clinical side, that same fee is $50. Okay. Without getting into the initial license fees, which are a little bit more complicated, in terms of licensure renewal, okay, the new fees are, the new license fee types have been set up as two-year fees. For the RBSW, a two-year fee is for renewal is $100. For the LMSW, it's $200 for 2 years. Okay, at the clinical level, just for the comparison, our one-year fee for LCSWs is $130, so the two-year equivalent there is $260 for an LCSW. That's the very rough summary, and I'm happy to give you further detail later, but that's the, you know, that's kind of the big picture summary, and I hope that captured most of your questions. I think that covered most of them.
Exemptions. 10 minutes more.
Just exemptions.
Pardon?
Can I just ask if,
yes,
what are the exemptions for people to be able to practice?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Gagnon, basically the exemptions are, first of all, if you are licensed by another mental health regulatory board, you don't also have to become licensed with this board in order to engage in clinical practice. Second, if there is a specific exemption written in for what are called CADCs, I think that stands for Certified Addiction and Dependency Counselors, or Alcohol and Drug Counselors, and that is a kind of a semi-public, primarily private type of certification for those folks that provide these services. And basically, as long as they stay within the scope of practice for what that certification entitles them to do, they don't also have to come in to us to be able to continue their work. Third, within, and this was a huge deal, within the community mental health programs. We didn't want to do anything that would shut down anything or cause problems for our community mental health programs. Within those, there is what I would call not a license or a certification, but would rather call a employer-driven designation of qualified mental health associates and qualified mental health professionals. Those are specific designations that are in use in those programs. And in essence, it means as long as you are with one of those employers and you have that designation and you work within the scope of that designation and you do it as part of your job duties, you don't have to become licensed with the board. But you also have to remember that is employer-based, and we're very, very clear about that. So you step out of that work setting, you do something privately, you ain't covered by what you do work.
Yes, I think you answered the question. In the frontier rural areas, do you feel that the needs of the community will be met, given that we have a shortage of these kind of people anyhow, by passing this bill, or will this create a shortage in these areas that we typically don't have psychiatrists available? On the upper level, you understand my question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Chair Tomei, Representative Witt said there was a great deal of work done, and we wouldn't have gotten the support we did, including specifically from rural legislators, if we hadn't taken care of that issue.
Okay. And follow up, if I may. So this is specific with the exceptions to both private and public sector mental health services. Does this include schools at all, the counselors that you have in schools?
Chair Tomei, Representative Witt said, great question. Actually, in the school setting is that's a whole other ballgame, because on the school side, there are not very many social workers that are there. The counselors are all licensed through another entity,
right.
The Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. There is now a licensing option available through the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission specifically for school social workers.
Right.
There is a tiny bit of a tie-in between that piece and the board statutes that we took care of in the 2011 session with Representative Greenlick's help, that basically made sure that those folks that come in through TSPC as school social workers could use the title school social worker without having to become licensed with this board as well.
Thank you.
Great. I think there are enough questions. We're probably not going to be voting on this today, but I want to continue hearing from these folks. And then if we have any more questions, we can ask folks to come back. And we'll try to be specific about our questions here today at the end of the presentation. I wasn't sure if you were finished. I interrupted you. So were you finished?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I was finished. The last thing I was simply going to say is that we've had tremendous support in the community and from our associations, and I would simply, in the interest of time, ask that we move on to Ms. Outland on the definitions for a moment.
Great. Thank you so much for coming. Go ahead. And we have no more presentations, right? So could you see that the blinds are open? Great. Go ahead.
I'm Kathy Outland, for the record. I am a licensed clinical social worker, and I am a member of the Oregon Board of Licensed Social Workers. I thank you for having me today, and Chair Tomei and other committee members. I would just like to explain about the definitions, and so that you have a little bit of an understanding about where these come from, because we didn't make them up ourselves. And there's an Association of Social Work Boards, and it is a organization. The members are member boards who have jurisdiction over the regulation of social work in the United States as well as in Canada. And this organization provides and maintains and develops the licensing tests and the exams, if you would, for the licensure of the different levels for social work. And so this is really a national, international, if you would, organization that pulls in all the wisdom, if you would, from the legislatures, from the members of boards who regulate social work, from legal opinions, etc., and it's a wonderful resource. They develop the test items. I was lucky enough to be asked to serve as chair on the clinical practice analysis part of this exam, where they review all of the different tasks that social workers do. And they did the bachelor's level throughout the United States and Canada. They did the master's level. Again, they did the clinical. And they did the advanced generalists, which are the administrators who serve in organizations and are social workers as well, and do social policy and all those great things. So this organization has been very, very much an asset and a help to legislation, to boards, etc. And so the definitions that we have used as guides, not verbatim, word for word, but is from the Association of Social Work Boards, the Model Practice Act. And that came about in 1996. However, it has been amended up through the year 2012, and those amendments are done by the General Assembly of the membership boards and jurisdictions. So it's a pretty formal process to get amendments in. In addition, that we have the practice task analysis that studies all of the different jobs that we need to do as social workers at our various levels of education. And so what we have done is borrowed, if you would, the guidance and the wisdom of all of that to put that into our bill and to update our clinical definition, as well as to make it more clear to the master's level and the bachelor's level. And the side part of this, which we haven't really talked as much about, is the reason that we want to have this clear is so that our licensees and the people that we serve are best served for public protection. That really is our foremost important job that we do. And as that is the most important thing that ASWB and as regulators ourselves are very much in our heart to do, so that if you had a master's in social worker who is signs that they want to be licensed, they are signing up that they are going to follow the ethical standards in how they're going to treat their client or patient. And if they don't, unfortunately sometimes there are, they, consumers have a place to go to say, I got hurt. I have a place to go. And that social worker can be held accountable. And that's really important.
Okay, so. Thank you.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Gallegos.
Kathy, it's so nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
The process, I am curious about the process of developing these definitions. And so this national body is the source that you're describing. In the process of developing this, have you talked with the universities, with Portland State MSW program, or with the mental health division? I mean, associations, organizations within Oregon, I guess is what I was saying.
So let me take Chair Tomei and Representative Gallegos, if I could address this. First of all, this particular definition was established and developed over a very long course of time, and it included the social work regulatory boards, as I mentioned, the social work professional organizations. It had the credentialing groups. It had the accrediting bodies, and it also had all of the different kinds of levels of education involved. The schools are very much involved in this. So
the
continue.
Local schools.
No, the local, well.
University, Portland State and University of Portland Pacific.
If you would take that model and blow it up because what we're looking at is all the member boards have different, you know, there are professors, there are...
Sure.
So
can I ask this another way then? Do you plan to take this to those entities, the local entities, just trying to get their buy-in, basically?
I think I'll let Martin answer that, because I've heard it's been done.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, these definitions actually are not a new discussion item. I probably should have made that clearer, not just because they've been around in this national work, but also because in the initial bill that we brought to the 2009 session, those definitions were there. And we had to make that part of the discussion with the communities then, including very much the local schools, particularly Portland State was at the table, but others as well. So those definitions have very much been seen and reviewed within that local community because they were all part of the initial bill. These definitions you have here today in 2082 are about 98% of what was there in the original Senate Bill 177. If you take that original bill, not the bill as it ended, but if you take the original bill as it was introduced, Senate Bill 177, and you lay that side by side to the definitions in 2082, you'll see that parallel, and that this is not a new conversation. This has been going on for a long time, including with the local community.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Laura Mojeski, and I represent the Oregon chapter of the National Association of Social Workers. The NASW Oregon chapter has 1,800 members, and our mission is to promote, develop, and protect the practice of social work and social workers. I'm here today to simply put on record our support of House Bill 2082, which creates and modifies the definitions related to social work. This is a straightforward change, cleaning up language in current statute. NASW's executive committee voted unanimously to support House Bill 2082, and I urge you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Any questions? All right. Thank you. Before you go, do we have any questions? We want any of this panel to come back with an answer, and they could also respond. In fact, if you could put in an email maybe to our staff here some of the information you gave us today, including the material on the PowerPoint. Thank you. That would be helpful so we can review it before we have a work session on this. Anything else? Representative Gumbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. If I'm reading the last page of this bill correctly in Section 10, it says that should we implement these changes, that they will actually go into effect in January of 2015? And I'm just curious about that time frame.
I think, am I reading the right one? It takes place in 2013.
No, 2014.
Line 17. Page 6, Section 12.
I'm looking at
Section 10.
Says that this would go into effect in January of 2015.
Yeah. If we come up with it.
Action. Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Gomberg, excellent question, and there is a reason for this, and I'm glad you caught it, because it allows me to put it on the record. There is always a lot of work involved when you change definitions. It impacts a lot of people. And the reality is that this bill also includes very specific authority for the board to do further rulemaking and do further work with stakeholders. What we didn't want to have happen is that we would only have, if we come out of this session and have this bill go through, thinking optimistically, and we very much hope that's going to be the case, that we would only have 6 months to do that work. We wanted to have an extended period of time where we could make sure we could get everybody out there ready for this and have a reasonable period of time for a small agency to work through a heavy workload of the various parties and make sure that we can get the implementation piece right. That's what's behind it, and I'm really glad you asked.
Madam Chair, follow-up question. Thank you for that explanation, and I'm a little bit new at all this, so I understand what you're saying about the necessity for all the rule changes. Why do we have an emergency clause?
Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Comberg. This is where it gets technical, and I want to just say I'm not a lawyer, so I can't give you the full Monty explanation, if you will. Basically, my understanding is that we have to have the authority now to work on the implementation toward January 1, 2015. Okay.
And we can have Elk come in and give us an explanation.
Well, sir,
representative.
I appreciate that, and I'm sure if there are any lawyers in the room that they would appreciate it as well.
Thank you. Any further questions? And leave us your contact information, please, and then people can, if they come up with more questions before we have a work session, they can send them to you.
I just want to say thank you very much. I mean, it's a lot of work, and I know that the bottom line is really to protect clients and provide better standard of service. So thank you.
Thank you all very much. And there's no one else here to testify on this bill, so we will close the first public hearing on House Bill 2082 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2598. Okay, Regina.
2598?
Isn't that right?
Yes.
House Bill 2598 excludes from definition of gray machine devices that simulate casino games but only accumulate free plays for users.
Okay. So we have, pardon?
This bill has a fiscal impact and no revenue impact statement.
Okay, so we have Roger Martin, Michael Williams. We'll have those two people, and then we'll have the next panel. Hello.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm a lobbyist for the Oregon Amusement and Music Operators Association. With me is Mike McWilliams, who's the vice president of the group. Our president would be here, except he had an eyeball operation yesterday and is totally can't move for a few days. This bill is very similar to a bill that was here last session and was heard by another committee and eventually became a study group instead of a bill. And we met during the interim on three occasions with the Oregon State Police and the lottery, trying to work out a way to get a solution. In the end, we were not successful, and I'll give you a little bit more about that. In the end, what the State Police and the lottery suggested was a process to have an independent agency review each game that are on the amusement devices to make sure that they did not violate the statute. In view of the fact there are about 5,000 games available on this, we could see nothing but just a huge bureaucracy that was really not necessary. I want to give you a little background, because I probably know as much about this as anybody in the room. I was the main lobbyist that helped pass video poker in the late 1980s in the Oregon legislature. The state lottery commission studied the whole issue for about a year and decided the state would take over all video poker games and not do anything in the private sector. Within a year or two, they came back and said, we've got to make sure we don't have gray games, which were the existing privately owned video poker games that existed in the state prior to the passage of the bill. The state obviously didn't want them in competition, and the statute was passed. We supported that, had no problem with it. And I want to point out to you on page 2 of the bill, lines 30 through 32, describes the very thing we're talking about, amusement devices. That's what our members sell, lease to various bowling alleys, bars, taverns, and other retailers in the state of Oregon. I want to make sure you understand I'm talking about a group of very small independent businesses in this state. We're not talking about anything big, huge, and national. For over 10 years, that statute worked exactly this way. The amusement devices and the state lottery had started about 5 years ago. The State Police Division of the Lottery Protection one or two officers started making citations by saying that amusement device has a game on it called Jugs 21. And 21 means poker, and that's a violation. And we've gone around on this for the last 5 years. So let me just describe to you what happened. Michael Dantu is an operator that works in the Portland area. He's an immigrant from Ethiopia who's been here about 35 years. One of those success stories, became a citizen, became a small businessman. On a Friday afternoon last year, he was in his office in Portland and working in the back on some kind of a machine. One of the employees came back and said, Michael, there's state police here. He went out and they arrested him, not on a misdemeanor, but on a felony charge for having an amusement device that they claim was a gambling device. That device was in Banks, Oregon, in a small retailer there. They handcuffed him, drove him from East Portland to Hillsborough, put him in jail. He is a diabetic. He almost went into shock. It took about 3 hours for him to get the money, to get the bail, to get out. When that case was presented to the Washington County DA, he said, I'm not going to prosecute that, dropped it. Now, his machine, which is worth about $3,000, is still in an evidence locker. That's the kind of thing that's gone on. There was another case in Lincoln County where one of our friends was arrested. And in this case, he's both a tavern or bar owner that is a lottery licensee and a liquor licensee. And he was charged the same way. Nothing's been concluded that I know of yet, but he spent $6,000 on attorney fees defending himself. And I look you in the eye and tell you, and if we have another hearing, we'll bring a machine. These machines are amusement devices. You can't gamble on them. They have no counter in them. They have no way of paying off. But we've got this ongoing argument. It's not statewide. It's with two or three of the state police. I can tell you also that in counties like Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah counties, the DAs won't prosecute these because they've got an agenda of important things that's much higher than this. So our machines get picked up and put in the evidence locker, and they just stay there. Nothing comes of it. We do not want to repeal the statute. We think that the lottery does need a gray games statute. We're only asking that we go back, and we're trying, these may not be the proper words on page 3. We're trying to get back to this amusement devices other than gray games that do not return to the operator or player of anything except additional games, that we just adhere to that as we did for the first 10 years. If you can help us with that, we would really appreciate it. I would like to have the man that's really in the business that can tell you testify.
Thank you, Roger. We're going to let him testify and then we'll ask questions.
Up here. My name is Mike McWilliams.
I clicked on text.
Products.
Thanks.
Our base is in Milwaukee, Oregon. We're located right at the intersection of Ochoco and McLaughlin, right next to the LCC office. Perhaps you've seen us there.
Yes.
Okay. That's our base office. We also have an office in Seattle. We have an office in Salt Lake City as well, too. What we do mainly is we sell amusement devices. Some of our clients would be Big Al's, Pietro's down in Salem, the Wonderlands around Portland. We also deal with...
Hold on just a second. We need to get the microphone.
I'm sorry.
You should have two microphones. I don't know what's happened.
Right. Should I start over again? Am I okay?
No, you're doing fine. Right. Go ahead.
We also deal with a clientele that services the bar and tavern industry, as Roger reiterated. These are small businesses. There are roughly 38 of them in the state of Oregon that are mom-and-pop organizations. They supply jukeboxes, pinball machines, video games, ATMs to some degree to some of these bars and taverns, and provide services to the bars and taverns. And one of the games that they've had to supply to these bars and taverns are these countertop video games that the state has classified as gray. And these games came in after that gray statute. Okay, the gray statute was put in effect, and then these games came in back in 1992. There has been no instances of gambling on any of these games. You cannot gamble on these games. So they are a definite, distinct, different game than what the statute wanted to get rid of. and I can't don't quite understand why we have having such a battle getting these two things separated. I mean, we do have some opposition to this, and I don't understand what the opposition could be unless they think that our games are competition, which I know they're not, because they don't make that much money. I mean, we sell a lot of these games in the state of Washington. Everything's, I mean, and it's the same game in Washington than it is down here. We sell a lot of games in Idaho, we sell them in Montana, and there's no problems in those states whatsoever. But Oregon seems to want to define these as gray, and we don't quite understand why. They won't just separate the definitions, give us a distinct definition as to what they are, which is amusement devices, and let them go. The problem we face is that it's a felony, you know, for selling the game, which is what I do, to our customers for operating the game. It's a felony for our technicians to work on the games if they are under that gray statute, and they are not gray games. They need to be moved from that statute. This bill does take care of that. So we'd like to support on that.
So help me understand, if it's a felony to sell these games, how is it that you can stay in business?
As far as continue to sell these games?
Right.
Because a lot of the games that are on there are definitely do not fall under that gray statute. There's 125 games on these platforms, and a lot of them do not fall into that statute. Okay, a lot of them are like Pac-Man type games, for example. Okay. But there's some games, like Roger was pointing out, that are called Chug 21 that somewhat are a little bit similar to a poker game, and therefore they classify them as a gray game. But you cannot gamble on that game, you can't win money on that game, and that's the distinction. So what we do in Oregon is we put a key in each game, a select key in each game, that turns off those games that we feel are offending games, I guess is the best way to put it. Now, there's no black and white definition as to which games are offending, so we'll get a key in all our games that we sell, and sooner or later, a policeman's going to come along and say, well, that game there, that might be a gambling game too, so you need to turn that one off too. And it's been an ongoing battle.
If I owned a tavern, why would I want one of these $3,000, whatever you said, machine in my tavern?
Well, because they're an entertainment device. They sit on the bar. People sit at the bar and they play the game and they drink and they socialize.
And
they're a form of entertainment.
Do they pay for that game?
They pay 25 cents, 50 cents a game, yes.
So, and that money goes to the bar owner?
It's a split between the bar owner and the machine owner, yes.
Okay, thank
usually
you.
Usually a 50-50 split.
Representative Yeltsin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be similar to a restaurant that I go to and I can pay to play a trivia game?
Yes.
And so I pay every time I want to pay the trivia game. I'm not going to win any money.
Correct.
From it, but while I sit and eat, I compete against
trivia games. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Trivia. It's also one of the games that's on there as well too. Yeah. Puzzle games, picture games, all kinds of games like that.
Representative Liston.
I was wondering, for your 25 or 50 cents, how long does, you say the game, do you mean you can play the machine for an hour for 50 cents? Or
no, it's
how long
it's,
is the
yeah,
game?
Yeah, you choose a game, so you choose one of 125 games you want to play. You choose that game, you mm-hmm. put your money in, and you play for 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, depending on how good you are. Okay, and that's your entertainment. That's what you get for your money. You get nothing else, just amount of time and some entertainment, just like you're playing your Xbox at home or on your laptop computer.
So the better you are at the game, the longer you can play? Like, okay, mm-hmm. So if you're really good at something, maybe you can play for a quarter for 10 minutes on it or something?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
all right. Mm-hmm. I hope we're not taking away from anything there.
No, I was just making a point for me. Madam Chair, I guess my question is this a gray machine?
Well, I don't believe it's a gray machine. I'll let the state police tell you that or not. Computers, laptops, and personal computers are by statute exempt. And just as an aside, I'll bet you any amount of money, we're not supposed to be betting, that a lot more gambling is done on personal computers than anywhere else in the state of Oregon. But I don't know if that's classified as a personal computer. When the statute was written, those didn't exist.
Okay, we need to move on. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've got more questions after we hear from the next two people who are coming to testify, we can bring these folks back. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for coming. Greg Durbin in Herb Lovejoy.
where they are. Because you put it like a quarter.
Oh, Larry, you coming too?
That the line between what would be
all right
is not defined well.
Oh, I'm sorry. You were right there in the list.
Definitions
again. Okay. Left or right?
Yeah, if that works.
Okay, who's going to go first?
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, Larry Nicewinder, Lottery Director. I will lead off. To my right is Herb Lovejoy from the Department of Justice, and then to my far right is Major Craig Durbin from the Oregon State Police.
Great,
so,
thank you.
Apologize for not having the testimony in your computers. I wasn't sure you were working from hard copies or computers today, but in future I will make sure that happens.
Thank you.
Just briefly, Lottery has not taken a position on this bill today. We're just here to provide factual, historically relevant information to the committee that we think is relevant to the current law, share some policy considerations, and then address any questions you may have. So, no position. In my testimony, you will just see repeated, just for your reference as a document, the provisions that are in this particular bill, which are ORS 167-117, but then there are also five sections of that same chapter that are in my testimony that aren't in the bill before you, and it's just for ease of reference if you wanted to see some of the other statutes under that same chapter that relate to the use of gray machines. And what was already testified to is these the use of unlawful gambling devices is when it's used not on a machine is a second degree offense that is a Class A misdemeanor. When it involves a machine, you'll see at the bottom of page 2, that's where it falls into the category currently as a Class C felony, and so that's why the reference to Class C felony was made earlier. I would like to skip in my testimony after those reference materials really to page 4, if I could. And this is just for historical context. 2 years ago, a very similar bill was put before the legislature, and it was assigned to the Business and Labor Committee, House Business and Labor. And that committee did deliberate at length on this bill and got similar testimony that what you've received today and will receive from us. And then after that, they amended the bill to require a work group to be formed, and it passed in that form. And that work group did some work in the interim. And the charge that that bill gave the state police and this work group was go off and see if you can provide some process or procedure that would give these vendors and machine owners and software providers some certainty as to how they can avoid being caught up and having their machines seized or their software seized. And so that work group met, and it did come up with a proposed process and procedure. It wasn't unanimously supported, and the required report did go to the Judiciary Committee in the interim as the bill required. So we're back with the bill. It's really similar to the one that was there last two years ago. We can get a copy of that judiciary report to you if you would like. That's the recent history. So now I have to roll you back just a little bit farther, long before I was with the lottery, and that's just on page 5 of my testimony. It's just a section that just gives you information from a 1991 joint report. And it was a joint report between the Department of Justice and the state police that really wrestled with the issue of gray machines and their prevalence. And it recommended that gray machines be completely eliminated by legislative action due to the extent of illegal activity surrounding them. 22 years ago, that's what they said. I did put a copy of that report attached to my testimony just for your reference again. And in my testimony, just written documents, you'll see that it was widely known and accepted that these gray machines were used for unlawful gambling activities 22 years ago. I believe in testimony from the Restaurant and Lodging Association, you heard that prior to video lottery being authorized, their estimate was there were approximately 10,000 of these machines in possible use around the state. And they also testified that that's about 12,000 in today's terms for video lottery machines exist. I will say that at the bottom of page 5, just again paraphrasing portions of the report, there were a number of activities that the report highlighted that were going on through the use of these machines. And so the concern that they had was if these machines didn't exist, we would be able to address some of those illicit and illegal activities that they found were going on at that time. So the machines then did not dispense cash or coins, as you just heard the description of the machines that are currently being sought to be made legal. They did accumulate credits and free plays, and the part that became illegal is when the businesses using those machines for illegal gambling would pay the player for those accumulated credits or free plays. So that's just, that's history, that's what happened then. The recommendations of that 1991 report were that the lottery own, operate, and regulate video lottery, and that it not be done by any third-party providers. And I will, as I testified to earlier in my before the committee, the lottery does own, it does operate, and it does regulate a closed video lottery system in the state of Oregon. So these machines that were described to have 100 to 120 games on them are operated legally today. They are operated unregulated and independently operated as long as they don't have casino-style games on them. And so what we had proposed to do to eliminate the risk of seizure was to have the game sets tested by an independent lab and certified that they do not violate the laws in Oregon regarding gray machines, so that they would have certainty that they would not be seized. There would be costs associated with that, and I think that was one of the possible reasons why that avenue of giving them certainty wasn't necessarily favorably viewed. So just skipping to page 6 and just some of the policy considerations. So in effect, to authorize casino-style games to be on one of these machines, it is very close to authorizing private video terminal in terms of in its legal action. So that's something we just thought the committee would want to know. Additionally, as I testified to you when I was before your committee with an overview, lottery is highly regulated. There is a limit of machines in venues. There is line of sight requirements. It is supposed to be in an age control environment. Only 6 machines in any location. As it's written, I don't see any limit on any of those activities. Where, how many, the number, whether there's any age control environment. So just those are just policy considerations for you. And then, you know, to the extent that any of the revenue derived from these would be diverted away from video lottery, then it could have some effect on lottery's revenue. It could affect current retailers, small businesses that we do business with around the state. To the extent that something is used illegally, even though it's not designed to be used illegally, the criminal activity levels could create some law enforcement, need for additional law enforcement activities. So, and the last thing I did 2 years ago in preparation for discussion of this topic was I thought, you know, if there's information that's 22 years old, let's try to bring it current as best we can. And so the last section of my testimony is just page 7, just talks about the fact that I went out to a national organization that oversees lottery operations, and I asked them to do a survey for me of all the lotteries that are around the United States and asked them, you know, do any of you have gray machines? Are they prohibited or not? I was only able to get 16 jurisdictions to respond to that out of about 30-some. But in my testimony, you can just see that there was only one jurisdiction that actually had not, that does allow them, and that's Idaho. So there are those machines in Idaho. The second question we asked them was, what prompted the original prohibition on gray machines? And you see there are the bullets, the responses that were given back as to why they outlawed them in those other jurisdictions. And so I was curious about Idaho being so close and having not having any prohibition on it. So I did follow up with the director of the Oregon Lottery in Idaho, who also is the head of their Liquor Control Commission. And my testimony, it just says that they had received a number of complaints from citizens and sting operations were performed. And under those sting operations in Idaho, they discovered that over 92% of the time, the undercover officers were paid for points and credits or accumulated free games. So that's just a fact that Idaho, the director, told me about that. And then the last page of my testimony just gives you a statement that he made, I think, in the process of closing up that conversation that I thought was relevant for you to have for your consideration. With that, I'm done.
Thank you. I want to make a statement. I think maybe you might be wondering why we're hearing this here. It came originally from the Committee on Business and Labor. It's because we'll be hearing the lottery and gambling addiction bill, so that's why they were sent here. But I'll allow questions in just a second, but I'm sort of stuck on page 5, the August. So there was a requirement 2 years ago that there be a work group. So why haven't we heard from the work group?
Chair Tomei, committee members, that work group was required to provide a report to Interim Judiciary Committee, and it was probably a 2 or 3 page report that was turned into that committee.
That, right? Mm-hmm. Right.
So in September that was provided, and we would be able to give them a copy of that.
Yes, please get that to us. Remind me what the recommendation for that was, please.
Do you have it with you, Herb?
Just a brief summary.
It was two-pronged. There was a process and a procedure outlined in both of them, a process by which they...
What I want to know is what the report was in August or September.
It outlined both in a very brief statements about what process and what procedures would be recommended to provide the vendors with certainty as to whether or not they had casino-style games on their machines.
Okay. And we won't be having a work session on this, so if you will send that to us, that would be very helpful. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Larry. Any quick questions? Yes, Representative.
I just wondered if for businesses that have these games, can the machines be reprogrammed to omit the casino-style games so that they're left without having to purchase new machines but get rid of what you're worried about?
Chair Tomei and Representative Whitsitt, I would hope if I say something incorrect, somebody behind me will nod this way for you, but my understanding is those machines games can be turned on and off, and the mix can be controlled by the operator.
Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, you're page 7 where you say that there are sting operations 92% of the time. Unless you tell me how many facilities they are and how many inspections, that number doesn't mean much, does it?
No. If I can get that information, I will, and I think I agree that context is very important.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Kittigar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm almost embarrassed to ask this because you probably explained it and I missed it, but you made a compelling case against gray machines, and it seems that this bill is not about whether or not to have gray machines, but whether to take a couple of the games and remove them from the definition of gray machines. And then you also talked about going in and testing whether things were gray machines or not. And so I wonder if you could address the Chug 21 specifically. The bill is proposing to take them out.
Yeah.
And beyond that, whether gray machines should be legalized under the regulation of the Lottery Commission. It's a bigger question, not in this bill.
So I couldn't probably do a very good justice of describing that game, Chug 21. I don't know if the major could on my behalf. Does emulate a casino-style game. That's about the extent of my understanding. I'm not involved in the gray machine enforcement or detection, so maybe I could pass the mic over.
Okay.
Correct.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess. Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Gomberg, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Craig Durbin, and currently I am a major with the Oregon State Police and serve also as the Assistant Director of Security at the Oregon Lottery. And to answer your question, Chug 21, so this is where the work group tried to work towards defining, because in the current statute it says emulates a casino-style game. So officers throughout the state would go into a particular retail location, and from their training and experience, and granted, depending on what officer, what experience they've had in regulatory enforcement or criminal enforcement in the area of gaming or vice activities, if they were to go in and they were to look at a particular game, and we're talking about Chug 21, and determine that game based on their training and experience emulated or simulated a casino-style game. So in Chug 21, when you've got a game that is attempting through the game itself to get to a score of 21 and then receive credits and free basically playing. It's fairly complicated. We can show you. But through that, that would simulate or emulate blackjack. And so in the officer's opinion and training and experience, if they felt that they have probable cause to seize that game under that statute, that's what they would do.
Further questions? Larry, did you want to respond to that?
Representative had one additional question, and I don't know that I have a chance to address it, and it was, I think it was to the effect of, could the lottery, in effect, authorize and regulate these games and operate them legally? And I believe, I'll let the attorney speak if I misspeak on this, but my understanding is the only authorized gambling in the state of Oregon that can be done is that which is carried out under the approval of the Lottery Commission, with the exception of those games authorized under the tribal compacts. So I guess technically the lottery could operate that, but it would need to do it.
A bigger bill.
Okay. Go ahead, Tillman.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Herbert Lovejoy. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm the contact counsel for the Oregon State Police. I'm here in my capacity as that legal counsel. I'm not here in my capacity to represent the opinions or the positions of the Department of Justice, but to merely kind of walk you through some of the legalities of the gray machine statutes, and more importantly, give you some legislative history about why we have a Class C felony called possession of a gray machine, because I think context is everything. And I'm a big fan of going back if the legislature is going to take an existing statute and modify it or amend it, to go back and look at the reasons why the original statute was enacted in the first place. And so that's kind of my goal here today. I'm not here to take a position one way or the other on the bill or to say whether it's good or bad, but to simply give you a legal context of it. One of the first things I want to do is make a critical distinction, and what we're not talking about is we are not talking about devices that are gambling devices. Those are separately defined under statute. Those are the things that any person walking into an establishment can take a look at and know immediately that it's a gambling device. Everyone in this room knows what a slot machine is and knows that the reason it's a gambling device is because it pays out. You go in and you look at, for example, a lottery video terminal. It has a payout button. You hit it, it prints out a lottery slip. That's a gambling device. What we're talking in this context, these amusement devices, is not gambling devices because they do not print out or pay out from the device itself. That's a critical distinction. The gray machine statute is the what we're talking about, and that is a device, an electromechanical device, that has the ability of recording credits or emulates, simulates a casino-style game. And that last part of that definition is really where we drill down to the bedrock of the issue in this bill, is the emulates and simulates a casino-style game. Prior to, first up, the possession of a gray machine Class C felony statute was enacted in 1991 under House Bill 3151. And the legislative history demonstrates that prior to 1991, there were some significant problems, not only in Oregon, but across the country, but especially in Oregon, that needed to be addressed. And House Bill 3151 was part of a bigger bill that enabled the Oregon State Lottery to enter the video lottery, the poker machines. What was happening prior to 1991, according to the legislative history, is that there were unlawful gambling occurring. Again, not because the devices were paying out, but because people were playing amusement devices with gray games on them, casino-style games, would hit the royal flush, and the owners of the machines or the people behind the bar would go out into the back alley or under the table and would pay out the supposed winnings of that. Because it was unregulated, there was also underage gambling that was occurring, and The problem was is that because it's not a device that itself pays out, the only way law enforcement could actually determine whether or not there was illegal gambling going on in those establishments was to undergo undercover investigations in order to determine whether or not there were these back payments and these back alley payments were occurring. So as part of the Oregon Lottery entering the video poker part of lottery, one of the industry manufacturers from Montana who manufactured lottery machines came in and kind of did shuttle diplomacy between all of the various stakeholders, including the amusement device industry representatives. Mr. Martin was part of that legislative history in 1991. The only way to get local and county buy-off, because this was a local and county problem, the only way to get local and county buy-off, according to the legislative history, was to completely ban gray machines because of the problem of the under-the-table payouts and the underage gambling and the fact that these machines were in a public area where minors could access them. And so...
Can I ask a question there?
Certainly.
So you're saying they're not just in bars or taverns. They were in what kind of public places would they have been in?
Any public place that you could have it in an arcade, you could have it anywhere.
Okay.
And so as part of House Bill 3151 being introduced in 1991, and it was introduced and it was sponsored by the Oregon Sheriff's Association, but only after that shuttle diplomacy was happening prior to its introduction. And the Oregon Music Operators Association, again represented by Mr. Martin, signed off on the idea that all gray machines and all machines playing gray games would be banned in Oregon completely by the October 1st deadline set in the bill. That was an agreement by them. And this was based on the South Dakota model of self-policing, because you'd have this extreme felony prohibition. The gray machines would be removed from the state of Oregon as of a particular date, and then Oregon Lottery would come in and do the video poker. And part of the reason was that not only because the ability of self-regulation from the amusement industry, but also because there was a greater trade-off between the money that was coming in from the amusement devices versus the money that would be coming in from the Oregon Lottery machines and the sanctioned state lottery video poker. And so that was the agreement in 1991, why there was industry sign-off as to why we have a gray machine statute and why it's a Class C felony versus a Class A misdemeanor. Because right now, and since 1991, possession of a gambling device is a Class A misdemeanor. Again, you know it when you see it. But when you, the more insidious, if you want to call it that, problem with gray machines is you don't know if the payoff or the illegal gambling is happening unless you undergo that undercover investigation. And so that's the reason why it's elevated up on the level of criminal behavior, so that self-policing, there's a bigger chance that if you're doing this, it's going to have a bigger sting. That was what's embodied in the legislative history from 1991. So what does this bill, before I get into that, there is in the written testimony, the 1991, from October 1991, AG and Oregon State Police study from to the Oregon Lottery Commission. The investigation went into Canada, went into other states, and one of the things that has been pointed out, and again the legislative history reflects this from other sources besides just that report, is that gray games and illegal gambling from gray machines was rampant at that time, not just in Oregon, but it was across the country. And so that is one of the reasons why gray games became a Class C felony and became prohibited across the board. What this bill does is it attempts to create the carve-out for amusement devices that have the ability to emulate, simulate casino-style games. This bill, the legal effect of it is resetting current law back to pre-1991. In other words, all of the considerations that the Oregon legislature had in 1991 about underage gambling, about illegal payoffs under the table, all of that is once again on the table for consideration by the legislature under this bill. That would be the legal effect of House Bill 2598.
Chair. Thank you, Chair Tomei. I understand the concern you're expressing here, and I'm looking at the addition of a Section G that would exempt amusement games that simulate casino-style playing. And I'm trying to understand the difference between that and just above in Section D, where it indicates that slot machines are currently not gray games. Could you help me understand the difference between amusement devices that simulate casino-style play and slot machines?
Okay, a slot machine is by definition, because it is a device that pays out a slip or pays out money, that's a gambling device. Okay, a gray game is something that doesn't do that by virtue of the device itself, but nevertheless emulates or simulates a casino-style game. So if it has something that emulates poker, 21, blackjack, AC Ducey, the list of casino-style games is codified in the statute. So if it emulates or simulates that kind of game, even if all you're doing is putting in a quarter and you're getting continuous play, if it emulates or simulates that kind of casino-style game, that makes it a gray machine. And so when we're talking about these amusement devices, we're not talking about these devices that are amusement devices that have pinball on them or that have some other trivia game or compare the two pictures and see what's different or, you know, crossword or something like that, because those aren't casino-style games, and it's not, and those type of games are not emulators or simulating casino-style games. It's only that portion of the game, the device, if you're talking about a multi-game device, that where it starts emulating or simulating a casino-style game, that now you've entered into the gray machine definition. And that's what is currently prohibited under Oregon law. In essence, what happened in 1991 is the legislature had basically said any gray machine is contraband, period. That was the intent of the 1991 legislation.
To follow up, one of the concerns that you have are the accumulation of points that are being paid out illegally, if I go back to the Idaho sting operation. What is to prevent the people who want to circumvent the law from accumulation of points through pinball or any of these other arcade games and still achieving the same payout at the end of it? I mean, isn't that what's going to happen? Don't people always find a way to circumvent something? I mean, you know, you add up your points and go back out in the alley and pay off.
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, I'm not going to say it's a perfect system. However, the thrust of it was because of lottery coming in with the video poker, and the idea was the definition of gray machine having the emulate simulate was to target that kind of illegal gambling when you're doing it based on a casino style game. That was the target for the 1991 legislation. Yes, is it possible that you could bet on a pinball machine? I suppose it could be. But if you think about it, there's a difference between playing a pinball machine and getting an additional credit for free play and having a pay table when you're playing poker, where you get two additional plays for getting two pair and you get 1,200 if you hit a royal flush. And so that's really the target, is that, that fundamental difference between having a pay table and emulating and simulating a casino-style game. Where is the real danger that you're going to have illegal gambling, underage gambling? And that was the target.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, one short question.
It has some, it's sort of like in a different direction, but more germane to this commission, I think. Is there any issue with addiction with regard to these gray machines?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos, I can't speak to that. All I can tell you is that that was an additional concern of addiction when Oregon Lottery was coming in with video, with state-sanctioned video lottery, and as part of House Bill 3151, there was money, I believe, and I think Mr. Nicewinder can confirm this, that there was money set aside for that addiction piece of it, and it seems that if you've got illegal gambling going on because of these gray machines, what really is the difference is the ultimate question to be decided by the committee. Is there a difference if you're doing it illegally or if you're doing it state-sanctioned? Is there still an addiction problem? That's a good, very good question that I guess would also be in front of the Legislative Assembly to decide if, you know, what to do with this bill. The last thing I want to comment on, Chair Tomei, you had, I think, kind of touched on this, and that is that one of the newest things that is happening, and I believe that Major Durbin will comment on this, is the advent of what's called an Internet cafe. And there will always be people trying to get around the law. And a lot has happened in 20 years since 1991. Technology has blossomed. Internet cafes are internet cafes. They don't serve alcohol. They don't have necessarily state-sanctioned lottery. But they have rows and rows and rows of personal computers. And individuals pay a fee to come in the door. They sit down and they play casino-style games. And the payout, if you will, isn't that the machines are paying out. It isn't that there's a direct money being paid out. It's that for that entrance fee, you've now entered a sweepstakes. You win a trip if you get the royal flush. This bill would allow internet cafes in Oregon. And that's something, again, whether or not that is good or bad, I'm not here to comment on. That is a very real likelihood under the language of this bill, and that is something that the rest of the country is seeing, and again, Major Durbin can comment on that, but that is something that could happen in Oregon under the language of this bill. Thank you.
Chair, just to clarify on that, on the bottom of page 2, it indicates that personal computers are already exempt from the definition of a gray machine, whether they're played on my kitchen table or in an internet cafe.
That's correct.
So, but you're saying that this bill would change?
Well, because you're now, if you're, because it's a personal computer, whether you play it personally in your home or you play it right here, you're playing it just for your own personal amusement. The problem with the internet cafe, and again, Major Durbin can comment on this, is that when you're paying a fee to go in and play what is ostensibly a personal computer for a casino-style game and you're entering a sweepstakes, now you're starting to get into that area that the 1991 legislature was concerned about, as far as you've tied that personal computer to some sort of gambling. And that's the issue, I guess, is that something that the legislature wants to engage in at this point?
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given the changes in technology, wouldn't bars and taverns and other restaurants already be able to legally operate these devices under the current definitions? For instance, if they set up some sort of a linking online game and people brought their iPads or their other personal digital devices and they created an app, couldn't they then just skip the machine and play the game, whether it was for non-gambling or gambling purposes, depending on how we look at it?
Well, if Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, it is certainly possible that if, again, you're using your personal computer, you're connecting to other individuals on the internet, you've removed the operator, you've removed the individual from having the gray machine in which the money is being inserted. So you've removed it completely from the possession of a gray machine because that individual is operating their own personal device and connecting with others through the internet. So I don't believe under the current statute that would be regulated as a gray game or a gambling device.
Can you follow up? Thank you. So I kind of did a quick Google search for Chug 21, and it says, in Chug 21, you're a busy bartender who must stack numbered mugs to add up to 21. Sign up for Turnamax XXX today and compete against other players on a local, regional, or even national level to rack up high scores, bragging rights, and great prizes. Mm-hmm. So what under our current law would prevent a restaurant or a bar or a tavern from creating the app that allows people to come in and they're buying the app, or they are buying the access to whatever that site is? It's not linked through a device, but that same activity, which is basically creating an internet sweepstakes, is taking place through a personal device. I guess would that be legal? And doing the same, basically the individual comes in with their own device instead of using the device that the store owner uses, but the store owner makes money in the same way.
And I'd have to look at Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser. I'd have to look at that more closely and kind of analyze it in terms of the personal computer exemption, because I think that's where it really would come in as to whether or not is that really a person using a personal device for their own amusement, or because there's the purchasing of an app and the person that they're purchasing the app from is getting a portion of the proceeds, does that cross over into the line of taking it out of truly a personal computer and now you're into the gray, not to coin a pun, but the gray area of a gray machine?
One follow-up comment, Chair?
Yes.
So I guess the point of the question is the problem the technology or the platform on which the game is played, or is it a behavior or set of games and behaviors that need to be limited? And has the advent of technology really made this statute obsolete? Wouldn't it make more sense to just describe the game and internet cafes and say you can't do that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, I think where it really comes down is the fact that you've got a prize involved, you've got consideration. Whether you're paying for it by an app or you're actually getting money as a payout, and then you've got consideration for the privilege of having that app and connecting with other gamers, you are getting something in return. That, I think, is where it falls into the definition, or could fall into the definition of unlawful gambling and gray device.
Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just really quick, I think I agree with what Herb's saying there. I mean, he uses consideration. I say risk. The prize is clearly identified, and then there's something of value as well. I mean, you just hit the head on what gambling is.
Okay, Representative Gelser, it's clear we're not going to be able to get to your bill. Are you okay holding it for next week?
Fine.
Thank you so much. And because we want to hear from you, sir.
Again, Chair Tomei, co-chairs, member of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin, and the department currently is neutral on this bill. In the interest of time...
Your department is?
I'm sorry, Department of State Police. Thank you. In the interest of time, and I won't go through my entire testimony because most of it has been covered already, I just want to, again, just touch and reiterate that prior to the 91 legislature, in 1989, the legislature did pass a bill for the Oregon Lottery to have line games, but in that version of the bill, it allowed the cities and counties to opt out if they so chose, and 35 of the 36 counties opted out. The reason that they opted out was that they were citing that they had already had too many enforcement issues with gray machines. And from the privately owned companies that were supplying to local bars and taverns. And so in the 1991 legislature, in that legislative action, it actually had the prohibition on gray machines. But after that legislation was passed, Governor Roberts at that time said that she wanted to have a very tightly security-conscious, controlled video lottery system and one of the best in the nation. So that's really what kicked off the evaluation, the study by the Department of Justice, by the state police, looking at and evaluating other video lottery systems throughout the country. It also had the hearings by the Lottery Commission throughout the state with retailers and your constituents out at that time. And because of that, it came back and the regulatory framework that is put into place currently was put into place. It's that framework that is today, I think, is the crux that in the current statute it says that it talks about the gray machine, and the gray machine awards the credits or accumulates the credits, but it has or and emulates a casino style game. Those are two critical components in that legislative act. And so because of the current framework that we have in place, that's what's at issue today, is the emulates a casino style game. And those same regulatory concerns that were brought forward both through the evaluation that was done by the Department of Justice and the Oregon State Police and through the Lottery Commission and the testimonies that were held prior to that regulatory framework, those same concerns are existing today throughout the country, and they're in the brief that I was provided to you by the American Gaming Association that speaks to the internet cafes, that speaks to the issues that they're currently dealing with in the gray machine area. So that concludes my testimony, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
Representative
Wilson. Thank you, Madam Chair. Craig, I don't want to, this is kind of something that was brought up earlier that Roger Martin had mentioned, and I'm just wondering if you could kind of give a little light on this. What it was that he had mentioned of an episode where a gray machine had been seized, and then there was nothing filed with the DA of Washington County, but yet you still have possession. I don't know if you do or not, but apparently, you know, from what it was described as, that the state police hung on to possession of that. Can you kind of explain to us a little bit, you know, what's gone on with that or what your position is on that?
Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, representatives of the committee. When we take, and because it is a C felony, when we take and seize one of these devices for probable cause, it then goes into contraband, as the law states. And then we take and file with the district attorney's office, and the district attorney's office decides whether or not to prosecute. If they elect not to prosecute, the way that we have to then deal with that evidence at that time is go and receive a court order for either what the court decides, whether it's a return or destruction of the evidence. And so we have to go back to the court. We currently are in the process of that. It is a slow process, and it is something that we're working on with the court systems at this time.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions? Representative Gumbel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to make sure I understood that correctly, Major, the machine doesn't belong to the tavern operator. But if the tavern operator misuses the environment to create a gambling situation, the machine can be held or destroyed?
Chair Tomei, Representative, Vice Chair Gomberg. So we go in and the machine has what is considered a casino-style game on it, at that point then that if it's in the officer's opinion that it has that casino style game, it's a crime, it's a C felony. The machine at that time, right now, what we're doing is actually giving a warning to the operator of the establishment and saying that game needs to be removed. The officer will then come back, and if that game is not removed off of that device, the machine will be seized, and if, depending on the situation, the person could actually be placed into custody. Once that machine is seized, then at that time it goes in as evidence of the crime, and it can only be released or destroyed upon a court order.
Any further questions?
All right, thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Any comments about this? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2598, and I will not be having a work session today. And if you have any questions for these gentlemen, I think you have their contact information. If you would email them or call them and ask them for any more information. And I'm sorry, Representative Gelser, that we didn't get to your bill, and so I will carry that over, right?
Take your car.
A later date. I want to thank you all for being such great members, and thank you for not bringing your electronic equipment the first two meetings, but you are free to bring them from now on. It was nice and quiet over here. I appreciate it. You're not using electronics, but I can understand why you need to. With that, anything else for the good of the order? Thank you all. Have a great weekend, and I will close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.